In the 1990s, as environmentalists, unionists, and citizens groups clashed with police outside the WTO negotiations in Seattle and similar international trade meetings around the world, globalization was the watchword. The belief that corporations were becoming more powerful and bypassing the ability of individual states to control was shared by both the protesters outside the meetings and by the corporations and policymakers inside. However, the massive government intervention in the economy since the financial meltdown of 2007 has led to many studies suggesting globalization is taking a back seat in the face of more activist government policies. The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire by Leo Panitch and Sam Jidden, takes a different approach, arguing that capitalism has always relied on states' intervention to keep trade flowing. Joining me to talk about their book is Leo Panitch, Canada Research Chair in Comparative Economy at York University. Welcome to Mud and Water, Leo.
Glad to be with you.
So the U.S. has been central to global capitalism since the 20th century, and America brands itself as the home of laissez-faire, with minimal government intervention to keep the economy running. However, you show that the U.S. has been far from minimal, both domestically and internationally.
Yes, I think that's true. It goes all the way back to the 19th century when the policy of laissez-faire, quote-unquote, was allegedly trumpeted. No, the American state, in fact, any capitalist state, is heavily involved in creating the conditions for markets to exist, for labor markets to exist, for contracts between businessmen which need to be policed in courts and property protected. And that's mostly what courts do, of course. Mostly what lawyers do is deal with protecting property and dealing with contracts between businesses. So that's a very old story. In the American case, they had a high degree of trade protection, of tariffs through the 19th century, but in the 20th century, especially since 1945, they've pushed for more open world borders. But their main concern has been to promote the free movement of capital, the ability of multinational corporations to invest around the world. And they've done that in a very general way. They haven't just acted for American capital in that respect. They've acted for capital internationally, and it's generally true that most large property owners and wealth owners look to Washington as the ultimate protector of their property, insofar as a left-wing government might get in and take some of that away. Most capitalist classes around the world look to the United States to protect them.
Now that brings us to a point that you also bring up about, although the state is responsive to capital, it is also in some sense autonomous. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that we often have the sense that because of the finances of businessmen, because of the close personal ties between so many politicians and bureaucrats and businessmen, we kind of have an image that governments are run on the basis of a big corporate executive calling up the prime minister or finance minister and telling him what to do. And I don't think that's the case. I think that, and this is certainly the case with the U.S. Treasury or Federal Reserve, they often provide leadership to businessmen. Businessmen are looking at the bottom line. They're concerned with securing their market share and don't see the big picture in the same way that people who go into the state as a career do. Now, that said, what really limits their behavior, however, is their own dependence in a capitalist economy on successful capital accumulation. Therefore, they're dependent on it for their revenues. They're dependent on it for their legitimacy If you have high levels of unemployment, it undermines government's legitimacy. So I think that we need to understand the extent to which states facilitate the expansion of capital and are concerned with reproducing capitalist social relations. That is mainly because the states, over time, became dependent on private business, and not so much because they're controlled by private businesses. That's not to say that that doesn't exist, for heaven's sake. It does. But it's really a subsidiary explanation rather than the fundamental one.
So one of the trends that we've seen over the last 25 years or so is the growth in international trade deals. Canada's entered into a number of these kinds of trade deals like NAFTA and most recently CETA with Europe that seem to weaken the power of the state and weaken the ability of government to protect citizens and intervene in the economy in various ways. And some have argued that weak states are beneficial to corporations in that they reduce environmental regulations and provide fewer worker protections.
I think that's all true, but it doesn't take weak states to do that. It takes strong states to do that. They are gaming the system, if you like, to the benefit of capitalist competitiveness. And it took, it's not corporations that sign free trade agreements. It's governments that sign free trade agreements. And precisely what free trade agreements do is they establish certain guidelines for legislation, regulation, et cetera, so that it's of a kind that promotes competitiveness and is open above all to the free flow of capital, and that treats foreign capital the same as domestic capital. So that hasn't taken weak states to do. It's taken strong states to do, and it's involved, especially on the part of the American state, the quite conscious attempt to reconstruct other states so that they follow similar policies, pass similar legislation. That partly involves having strong courts and relatively autonomous courts so that foreign capital can, in a given country, be sure they can go into the court and not find that some friend of the Chief Justice is protected, whereas they're not protected by the rule of law. So this takes strong states, not weak states. It was a fundamental misunderstanding that globalization was about capital bypassing states or escaping states or marginalizing states. Not at all. When capital crosses a border, it doesn't go into the ether. It goes into another jurisdiction. And why we call the American state an empire is precisely because it has played such a crucial role in remaking not only international law, but through remaking international law, remaking domestic law in terms of orienting it to promoting the competitiveness of capital. And you're right, that does mean that certain types of restrictions on the freedom of capital of an ecological kind or labor protections do tend to get weakened. That's true. But to think that states ought to be doing those things involves an assumption that they are fully autonomous from capital. As I said, they're autonomous from pressures, opinions, dictates by individual businessmen, but they are utterly dependent on capital accumulation. And the only way to get out of that is, in fact, to take the decisions about what's invested, where it's invested, and how that investment is planned out of the hands of the giant corporations that determine all of our lives.
Now, Globalization, of course, is nothing new. Even in the 1840s, Marx and Engels in their Communist Manifesto talked about a future, about the global expansion of capital and tearing down national barriers. The universal interdependence of nations was the phrase they used. And in a lot of ways, their prescience about globalization has been acknowledged across the political spectrum.
Absolutely.
One of the things that that signaled for a lot of interpreters of this was that there would be an international class struggle, and that the international working class would struggle against global capital. Even though crises of capital in recently, especially the most recent Great Recession, have been global, the conflicts tend to have been confined in nation states, as I understand it. Why has this happened?
These are very good questions. Marx and Engels were very prescient. That said, while globalization through the 19th century, if you like, continued apace, by World War I, with the inter-imperial rivalry that developed and the war itself, and then with the Great Depression, people might have thought that, which interrupted that globalization, people might have thought that globalization, far from being inevitable under capitalism, was impossible under capitalism to see through. And our book really details how, after the Second World War, it took the American state, which had to develop certain capacities to do this, which it did in good part through the institutional developments that occurred during the New Deal. And then they took that domestic type of capacity and externalized it. It took the American state to play the kind of role that would get globalization going again. And although a lot of people predicted at the time of the crisis of the 1970s that the United States was losing that capacity, that Germany and Japan were challenging the United States for global leadership, etc. On the contrary, what had happened was the development of very, very close linkages amongst these states, especially, I'm not speaking here of the security and intelligence apparatus or NATO, the military apparatus, but linkages between finance ministries and central banks, which under American leadership saw through the neoliberal reforms, which did involve an assault on labor, that got capitalism back on track again in the early 80s. Now, why national identity, why class struggles continue to take place at the national level is an interesting and difficult question, but you may remember that in the same Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels say that although the struggle is international, it always takes a national form, and that the first task, the first challenge of workers as they organize is to struggle against their own bourgeoisies. And I think one has to recognize, and this also has to do with the centrality of the state in the making of capitalism, is that both capitalists and workers identify with their state culturally, linguistically, and depend on them for legislation. So globalization has never been about internationalizing and leaving the state behind. If you look at this more dialectically, if I may use that term, globalization involves the internationalization of states in the sense that they begin to take responsibility for the making and reproduction of a global capitalism, but that is, in a sense, enhances their role insofar as they internationalize in that sense. I'm not speaking of, you know, international institutions governing the world economy. I'm speaking of state institutions doing so. So, you know, the Canadian Central Bank, the Bank of Canada, was the first central bank to opt in the mid-1970s for monetarism, which was a high interest rate policy designed to squeeze the economy to produce high enough unemployment as to break the backs of labor militancy. And they made it quite clear that they weren't doing this only to manage the Canadian economy, but they were doing it in order to contribute, to set an example for what other states should do in order to get out of the crisis of the 70s in a way that reproduced and extended capitalist competition. That's the way I think we need to look at this. So it's not surprising that what we see in this crisis is not conflicts between states, and much less capital bypassing states. They become more dependent on the bailouts of states, on what the American Treasury calls failure containment, which the Federal Reserve, which acts really as the world central bank, has practiced remarkably during this crisis and kept unemployment from going, except in Greece, to Depression-era levels.
That's going to... we're going to have to wrap it up, but it's given us lots to think about, Leo. I've been speaking with Leo Panitch, Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy at York University and the author of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of the American Empire. You are listening to Mud and Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.